Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Corey Foster. Foster is a general surgeon on staff at Surgical Associates of Ithaca at Cuga Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Corey Foster.
Thank you for having me.
You know what I want to know? When did you start having an inkling that you actually wanted to have a career in medicine?
Probably in high school was the first time I sort of thought about it. I had no idea what was involved. I had no family members that I knew of that were in medicine, but I sort of realized, well, I like science and I like the arts, and what can I do that'll combine the two? And it sort of dawned on me that medicine might be the way to go. I'd read a lot of Chekhov or something, and so, and I kind of put it on the back burner for a while, but came back to it, you know, full steam.
Mm-hmm. And did it take you a while to realize you wanted to be a surgeon?
That was a kind of a revelation. When I started medical school, I kind of ruled out surgery, recognizing that the residency was extra long and the lifestyle would be pretty rough. I sort of said, no, that's not anything I'll do. And then, you know, as part of a medical school curriculum, you rotate through different subspecialties. And when I spent my time in surgery, it was sort of no turning back after that.
Huh. Well, what was it that caught your interest? The intensity of it, perhaps?
I think that's part of it. Hmm. It's different than other fields in medicine. It has the sort of instant gratification of fixing a problem. You know, when all goes well, you've really fixed a problem instantly, as opposed to sort of internal medicine where you have to work long hours and put in a lot of time working with people to, I don't know, get them to take their medicines or do what they have to do to stay on track to be better. I mean, it works. That works, too, but it's a much longer course, and the results aren't as gratifying.
So dare we say that being a surgeon is cut and dry? Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard anybody
say that. You had to get that one in there.
I didn't expect to, actually. But you did your general surgical residency at the Medical College of Pennsylvania. It says you did clinical research in the intensive care unit. What is that? What does that mean?
So between my, I think, third and fourth years, I took a year out of the call schedule and spent time only in the intensive care unit. I was sort of the senior resident in the intensive care unit. The first and second years that came through looked to me for guidance and support in everything they had to do and sort of teaching. Mm-hmm. And in that year, it's the intensive care unit. The time is very intense. And the things I did that I got out of it were long-term follow-up of some of these very ill patients who I got to see from, you know, onset of illness to end of illness, whichever way that might be. And whereas other residents would spend short chunks of time, a month or so, and these would be people who would be 6 months in the intensive care unit. And so I got the benefit of that sort of overarching sense of a patient's course in the intensive care unit. And along with that, all the skills and extra knowledge that comes with spending that intensive time.
Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself becoming too personal in intensive care units if you're caring for somebody over such a long period of time?
Well, you certainly get very involved with their course, their families, et cetera. I mean, there certainly, you know, have been times I've gotten very attached. And although a lot of times the patients that are that ill aren't really with it enough to know what's going on, so they don't so much have a relationship with you, but you have a relationship with them.
Yeah, and you obviously have a relationship with their family members.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would think that would be incredibly intense and difficult.
At times, dealing with emotions.
And as well as medical problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you went on to become a surgery fellow in surgical nutrition at Johns Hopkins. Well, what is surgical nutrition?
When a person is very ill, often they can't feed themselves, and have to get nutrition through other means. Sometimes that's intravenous, and then it requires a specialized intravenous line that can stand a long time. And sometimes it's through a tube that goes into the stomach or the small intestine. And my job involved monitoring, placing those lines, and monitoring what was happening with their nutritional status. Once we take over feeding instead of a person feeding themselves, things can happen that aren't right. And so you have to monitor closely and make sure things mm-hmm. go right.
Did you have to learn a lot about nutrition just in general in order to take on a job like that?
Well, I think that there's nutrition and there's nutrition. I mean, I think that nutrition that a nutritionist learns is more along the lines of what I was doing, where I'm watching little numbers of you know the various minerals and micronutrients, but I think nutrition like you know someone who's
balanced
trying to
diets and stuff, yeah,
trying to do a balanced diet is sort of a different category of nutrition.
Uh-huh. But and as a surgeon and a physician in general, do you think nutrition is something that's neglected in regard to medical care in this culture?
Well, I mean, as a healthcare professional, I think we're certainly, this culture is probably suffering from understanding of nutrition, you know, misunderstandings of nutrition mm-hmm. or not paying attention to nutrition. Mm-hmm. And that's manifested in the sort of obesity epidemic that we're having. But in the hospital venue, nutrition is sort of one of the things on the checklist that we're watching out for. And so all that I would say the physicians I work with and myself, you know, are paying close attention to an individual's mm-hmm. nutritional status. But that's something different than, like yeah. you're saying, the sort of yeah. what the culture is doing.
Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of preventative medicine. I mean, mm-hmm. how big is that in the circles of healthcare professionals?
Well, you know, I can't speak for the yeah. primary care physicians sure. who are really on the forefront of preventative care, such as it is now. Yeah. I think you're probably right. We don't have enough information about how to prevent illness to be wisely advising our patients. So, you know, definitely more work can be done there. The surgical job comes after somebody's already failed in their prevention, generally. you know, like I said, I'm not at the forefront of yeah. preventative medicine.
Yeah. You know, I know there's been much written about how physicians have this inability and lack of training in regard to communicating with patients. Do you think that the fact that more women are getting into the profession has helped with that, or is it changing just in general?
Well, I'd have to turn that back to you and say, what do you think? Do you think it's changing? I mean, I'm on the inside.
Yeah,
and
you know what? I think you still have to be pretty darn assertive mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. get anything out of a physician or a healthcare mm-hmm, person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And sometimes when you when you are educated, mm-hmm. Some of the medical people I've met are somewhat offended because they think you're not really educated like they are, and mm-hmm. you know, I still sense an arrogance. I must say, not with all,
mm-hmm.
but I would think that the medical profession would appreciate people being educated about their bodies and medicine. But I haven't gotten that a lot from the people I've gone to.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that because I think it hasn't changed much yet. And we do need to maybe do a better job of educating our up-and-coming physicians about communication.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, personally think the women physicians I've talked to, and I feel like we, in general, do a better job of communicating with our patients than our male colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But we might be talking off our heads. You know, we're not in the room with them when they're communicating, so we only know our own experience. So I'm not sure that's fair to say, But I can say that I've heard from my patients mm-hmm. that they feel like I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, maybe because I'm female or maybe because I was older when I started and sort of more settled in my personality, or maybe just something mm-hmm. integral to my personality. I don't know.
Was it difficult for you as a woman coming up as a surgeon? Is it still primarily a male discipline?
It's still primarily a male mm-hmm. discipline. It's sort of the last bastion in medicine. But the place where I trained had a, although not perfect, had a history of being proactive for women. It's the former women's medical school, medical college. And so starting back in 1850 when it first formed, it...
That's the one in Pennsylvania,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
It was the, you know, at that time it was the only place for, one of the few places women could go to medical school. And I was lucky to have, and so it continued that tradition for many years. It only went co-ed in 1973, I think.
Really?
And I was lucky in my training that I had several women surgeons to be mentors for me and my fellow female surgeons. And I had the sort of unique experience of my graduating year of the three of us, two were women. So that was a little unusual. And so I did not have the, what I've heard, horrible experience that many
yeah.
women have had. I mean, the first female surgeon at Hopkins couldn't take call alone because
really?
They didn't trust her and
oh, God.
You know, things like that. So, yes, historically the field has been male dominated and women have been discouraged from being in it, typically. I feel lucky that in general I didn't run into that. I had a couple of, incidents that reminded me in my even in my program that the world hasn't changed completely because,
right.
you know, I for example, I came back from maternity leave after having my older daughter in. The nurses said to me, you know, that guy over there said something like, that's why women shouldn't be surgeons. And it was, a colleague of mine, someone I had thought of as a friend, but here he was talking behind my back about how I shouldn't be a surgeon because I had to take 6 weeks of maternity leave. That, by the way, was all my vacation saved up for 2 years, but that didn't impinge on anybody else's time or schedule, except maybe his. And so it was, it's not completely clean
mm-hmm.
yet.
But yeah.
But we're doing better, there's a group of women surgeons called the Association of Women Surgeons that, you know, every year meets at the annual surgery meeting and discusses mm-hmm. issues related mm-hmm. to being women in surgery.
And offers support, I assume. Because
absolutely.
I'm sure there are still many problems for many women. And
absolutely.
Did you go to that school in Pennsylvania specifically because you knew it would be more friendly?
No, I.
It's obviously also a good school.
It happened to be, what appealed to me about it was that was part of it, and the fact that it had been the women's medical college, but also the sort of history of it, the fact mm-hmm. that it had been around for 150 years, seemed great.
Mm-hmm. Well, where are you originally from?
More or less the D.C. area.
Ah, okay, so that wasn't that much of a jump to go to Pennsylvania.
Right.
You know what I wanted to ask you, because you have worked in big cities. Has working in a smallish community changed the way you see your role as a surgeon or as a physician?
Well, not as a surgeon or physician, I think. It's allowed me to have a more balance in life maybe than some of my city colleagues mm-hmm. might. I have two kids, I have, husband, pets, house, garden, thing,
uh-huh.
Hobbies. And
but do you run into patients and so on
oh, yeah.
more so than you would in a big city or
oh, well,
or not?
That's very true, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I would assume so. It seems to me it would be more intimate in some ways to
yeah.
work in a small town.
I mean, I love that part of it. In Philadelphia, the... Not as much, but where the hospital was actually a somewhat close-knit community. And so you treated your neighbors and you treated people that you knew, that you worked with and things like that. So there was a little bit of that there, but clearly it's more here. And I love that about it.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Dr. Corey Foster, a surgeon from Cuga Medical Center. Let's talk about breast cancer. You were a lead investigator in a local a diagnostic study regarding breast cancer several years ago. Tell us about that, and how much do you think we've actually progressed in the treatment of breast cancer?
So that study was looking at whether sentinel lymph node was something that we could take on here.
And explain what that means.
So sentinel lymph node biopsy. So the standard approach to breast cancer is to remove the cancer from the breast, either with lumpectomy or with mastectomy. And if it is invasive cancer, one also needs to assess whether the cancer has spread from the breast, possibly to the rest of the body. The first place cancer spreads is the lymph node system, and typically. And so our approach in the past has been to remove the lymph nodes from the armpit or axilla. The that process is fraught with complications. Lymphedema is the main one that people worry about, and that can be lymphedema of the arm, can be minor, or it can be debilitating. It's swelling of the arm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you've ever had your hand swell on a hot summer day, you can imagine how uncomfortable and possibly debilitating having your whole arm be swollen all the time could be. So the research was getting into looking at how could we limit the surgery on the armpit. And what it seemed to be showing was that if you consider the lymph nodes to be in a chain, there's got to be one lymph node that's the first one. Mm-hmm. And if you can find out if there's cancer in that first lymph node, you can decide whether you need to take more lymph nodes or not. If there's no cancer there, you don't necessarily need to look any further. And what they began to find is that, yes, in fact, the cancer does sort of behave somewhat orderly. It typically, all except for maybe 5% of the time, if there's cancer in that first lymph node, there might or might not be cancer further along, but if there's no cancer in that first lymph node, there's very little chance of there being cancer in any of the other lymph nodes.
That's interesting.
And so the process was finding out how can you identify that first lymph node. So it turns out that if you inject some radioactive material into the breast, it'll track along the lymphatic channels, lodge in that first lymph node, and light up on a scan. Same with blue dye. If you inject a little blue dye in the breast, it'll travel along the lymphatic channels and lodge in that first lymph node. And you can check with a Geiger counter, and you can check with your eyes and see the blue stained lymph node and find out that it's hot and remove that lymph node. And so that's one lymph node instead of, you know, 10 to 30 lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. That, you know, has been shown to be fairly accurate, and so we can generally limit how much lymph node dissection we do based on that test. So this study, this thing we were doing in 1998, was making sure that we had accurate results. When we did the sentinel node procedure, did it correlate with the regular axillary dissection, which at that time was the standard of care? Mm. And we quickly found out that it did, and therefore we were able to discontinue doing that because we now almost always do sentinel nodes.
Uh-huh. That's so that sounds like real progress, really.
That's one of the really nice things that's happened in breast cancer lately is that we can we're looking to doing smaller and smaller surgery to adequately treat breast cancer, and we're finding that we can do less and less.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about preventive care for breast cancer? Should women have what are those tests called?
The mammogram.
Mammogram. Mm-hmm. Now it just slipped out of my head.
Yeah.
Should they have those every year, every 2 years? Well, what is your thought?
Well, I've definitely had some patients who've had breast cancers caught on their annual mammogram that otherwise would not have been found because they're not palpable. You can't feel it. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I do advocate getting annual mammograms starting at age 40. And I have quite a few patients who've had their cancers found that way, so it's definitely worth it.
Hmm. Do you think we're very close to any kind of a cure for breast cancer? Do you think we ever will be?
I don't think...
Or can it even be looked at in that way?
Yeah, let's see. A cure, what would a cure be? it seems to me, so a cure is treating the breast cancer. And in fact, for some women, we do cure it already.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
it has to be caught early, and
and for a certain percentage of women, even with fairly advanced breast cancer, you're cured, but you, of course, mm-hmm. you don't know you're cured until you die of something else later. So, because uh-huh. you always have to watch out
right.
for breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone, we already have a cure, and the treatments we offer now do cure most women.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't know is prevention. We don't know how to prevent it, and I sort of had the sense that's what you were asking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't know how to keep a woman from getting breast cancer because we don't always know what causes it.
Yeah. Do you think there are environmental connections?
We don't know
for sure, right?
I think that people are pretty sure there are. I don't know that we know what they are, but
mm-hmm.
A lot of cancers are multifactorial. I mean, some cancers you can just say, oh, look, that person was in Chernobyl. They have thyroid cancer.
Yeah,
that's not surprising.
Of course.
But breast cancer is probably multifactorial. There are your genetic factors. There are your own body's immune system factors. There are the external, environmental factors. There are the diet factors. For most women, it's probably some interplay of all of those factors. And so it becomes very hard to sort out one thing to do to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think we're going to be able to prevent any disease.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
People used to predict that we in the 21st century, perhaps, we would have
right.
cures for everything.
Right.
Do you think healthcare in general would be better or perhaps more efficient if we did have universal healthcare? Do you think that's a great problem in our medical culture?
That is such a loaded question. And, I think that, yes,
it's a complicated question.
It's complex.
Yeah.
And I wish everybody had 100% access to health care, no restrictions, no worries about money,
mm-hmm.
because there are so many, people who wait until too late because of worries
inability to pay
about
mm-hmm.
not being able to pay or whatever or mm-hmm. whatever. That problem would be solved with universal health care. And so that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the right way to approach universal health care.
Yeah, I think that's the major obstacle at this point. Yeah, I think people don't know how to enact it in a country this large
mm-hmm.
and this fluctuating in regard to populations
and
so on. Well, would you want your kids to go into the medical profession?
Well, my older daughter's already said she won't. So
why is
fine.
That?
She
never sees her mom.
Well, she wants to get sleep at night. And, if she wants to get sleep at night, she probably shouldn't go be a surgeon.
Uh-huh.
My 3-year-old, I don't know. She looks like she's headed towards something scientific, so we'll see. And I guess it depends on where healthcare and training is in the future. It's very rough training, and I don't really wish it on anyone.
Really?
I used to say to med students who would ask me, I think I want to be a surgeon. What do you advise? I'd say, look, if you can do something else, you should, because this training is no fun and it's a big sacrifice to make.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't do anything else, then come be a surgeon.
So it really is a kind of form of study that could kill you, because it's so grueling. Discouraging people from doing it.
I don't know if I would say that it would kill you. I would say it's really tough, and you have to. I mean, I think my point is that you have to really, recognize what. You're giving up 5 to 10 years of your life totally to this. Nothing else happens. I don't know if it's true, but I used to hear about Duke that every single one of its residents was a divorcee. It's not a normal life, and don't think it's going to be. So, and then the other thing that's happening is It's probably getting to be not financially feasible to do it. You spend mm-hmm. so much money getting trained and educated to do the job, and then when it comes time to pay back loans, you can't make ends meet. And so that part has to work out too, because that's sort of, we're going to run out of doctors if they don't make something that people can. I mean, even if you're completely doing it for altruistic reasons, if you can't pay your bills, you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. What have been some of the surprises since you've gone through medical school and begun practicing? Have you been surprised by anything?
Well, I don't know. What do you think I would have been surprised by?
it seems to me what you were just talking about, maybe the difficulty of having a life and doing this profession.
I don't know. That was going on for so long, I forgot. I guess maybe the nice surprise is I have a life now, and that's nice.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever want to teach, or do you teach?
I mean, there's always a little teaching that's going on. The hospital has nursing students, new vision students with the high school, people that come through, and, you know, we do a little bit of demonstrating and instructing the occasional med student. But, no, I never really wanted to teach.
Really? Yeah. So you're still enjoying the intensity of being a surgeon, right? And that's
yes,
what I'm getting from you. Yeah. Is being a physician and working in healthcare changed you in regard to how you treat yourself as a woman? I mean, do you act differently in regard to your own healthcare because of how much you know?
Well, I'm responsible about my own healthcare, but I'm also irresponsible because I am so busy. I don't have a lot of time, so I don't eat well, for example. But I go get my annual checks and my mammograms and my whatever. And you know, a little bit of both.
Is it true that most physicians are terrible patients? you know how you always hear that?
Well, you know what happens is they diagnose themselves, and that's always a mistake. You have to let someone else do the workup because they have objectivity and you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Although they don't always have as much objectivity as they'd like or as they think they do, but, you know, so, you know, you always have to watch. I mean, every healthcare consumer has to pay attention to what's, you know, being told to them. But physicians have to not try and diagnose themselves. And physicians' family members have to try and not diagnose themselves.
Dr. Cora Foster, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.